listening to the only daily talk show in North America covering the world of football. This is World Football Daily.
Yes, 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 yes! It hits the back of the net! Oh my goodness me!
The world's game.
Oh, you're beautiful! What a head, son! What a head!
Our religion.
Brilliant goal! What an equalizer!
Our passion.
Go, go, USA! Oh, it's incredible! You could not write a script like this!
World Football Daily serves up the best football talk 5 days a week.
Oh! You will never, ever see a game quite like this! Unbelievable!
Milan bounce back and kick 2014 off in style as Kaká reaches 100 goals as the Rossoneri get a 3-0 win against Atalanta in Serie A season's football. There is a possibility of an upset, but I don't see it coming. Manchester United take on Sunderland away from home tonight in the Capital One Cup semi-final first leg. Can the Black Cats take on the Red Devils and pull off a big shot to send Moyes' season spiralling out of control? And some of the best purchases potentially in January. We discuss who your team should get. Get your thoughts as well. And who are the biggest choice buys from this January's transfer window? Welcome to World Football Daily. I'm Oliver the Juice Wilson, bringing you the news and the views from around the world of football. As always, joining me later on will be Big Rafa Gonzalez to talk all through some of the football action from last night in Serie A. We're also going to be joined in a moment by Richard Whittle, football commentator extraordinaire on all things Serie A. Roma fan, though, we'll try and be nice to him after their 3-0 loss to Juventus on Sunday. Monday night saw us have plenty of Serie A action, though, and the afternoon as well. Of course, a bank holiday in Italy Monday. And great day of football. If you're a Milan fan, 3-0 win to kick off the season. Very happy about that. As I say, Kaká getting his 100th and 101st goal for the club. I'm still not convinced by the youth at that the club, but I know Raf wants to talk about that a little later on. So we will get into that briefly. We've been talking yesterday about the magic of the FA Cup, whether it's here, whether it's gone. I know Rebecca Lowe out there on NBC Sports, and actually covering the Winter Olympics this year for NBC as well. She is still a big fan of the idea of cup magic and the magic of the FA Cup still being around. I wonder if the League Cup can provide that tonight, as I say, in their first semi-final, first leg, Manchester United taking on Sunderland up in Sunderland. But here's why I think the magic of the cup is slightly gone when it comes to mid-table Premier League managers. Paul Lambert was talking about how he didn't need the FA Cup coming around at that time, okay? And I get that the fans of clubs outside that top four love the opportunity and the idea of winning the FA Cup. It's a piece of silverware that they can nail into the trophy cabinet and have it there forever. A great bit of bragging rights when it comes to cross-fan banter. You know, we're the FA Cup winners. What did you win? Oh, we got fourth place. Oh, nice one, but that's, you don't get a trophy for that, do you? We got to go to Wembley and win the FA Cup. For managers, it's a completely different scenario, and here's why. It's because of money. As always, it all comes down to it. This is just the simple fact of life. Paul Lambert knows that if he wins the FA Cup but gets Aston Villa relegated come this season by putting too much emphasis onto the FA Cup, his bosses at Villa Park will sack him because the loss of money from leaving the Premier League is too much to lose. If the FA Cup maybe started later, and I mean later in the season, that would be change it, I think, different, make it completely different, because there'd be less kind of league positions up in the air. If teams can get their way through the kind of third, fourth, fifth round, that's when you see the mid-table side start to take it a little more seriously, especially if they've kind of embedded themselves in a safe spot in the Premier League. But the value of winning the FA Cup isn't enough for bosses to warrant sacrificing maybe Premier League status to take the hit and finances, go down to the Championship and come back up, but you've still won an FA Cup. Prestige isn't about it, it's about money. I got into a very long debate last night with somebody about this, and I don't like the idea of cup magic being gone. I think cup magic can still be there if you're a lower league side, especially when you get drawn against a big side, you take them on, maybe you get a draw at home, you get to go to Old Trafford, somewhere like that. Obviously not anymore because United are out. But, you know, that's when the cup magic is there. But I think for the mid-table clubs especially, who you would want to be kind of taking this competition extremely seriously from the get-go, they're not going to until they've got their Premier League status safe because of the money. And Paul Lambert knows that he'd much rather put out a reserve team in the cup and then have a full team ready to secure some vital Premier League points on the weekend, the following week, and not risk any injuries. Let's get out of that and let's get down to some positive talk about football. And, of course, get into a little bit of Italian football today here on World Football Daily. I'm delighted to say that we are ready to be joined by our guests for today. Here's a man who is all things calcio and coffee, one of our favourite Italian football commentators with an English or Irish accent, should I say, and a very good friend of World Football Daily, a man I'm going to have to apologise to later on as well on the show. We'll get into that in just a moment, because joining us now to talk all things Serie A is Mr. Richard Whittle, joining us here on WFD. Richard, mate, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show in the early January. How was the festive season, mate? I hope you had a good one.
Very good. Relaxing, of course. You know, Serie A had a break there for almost 2 weeks. And the great thing was to be back, actually. And it made me nice to have a break for a week or so. But one feels that for some teams, the festive break's what they need. But for others, you know, they come back and they come back a little bit slowly. And we definitely saw that over the last weekend. Of course, yesterday we had the matches on Monday because there's obviously a national holiday here, so they took advantage of that. So we saw some very interesting results.
It has been an interesting kind of first dive back into Italian football. I want to start and get this out of the way, because I don't know how much it will hurt, but the 3-0 loss to Juventus that Roma suffered on Sunday night. We said before the show, you said to me before the show that you don't see this as being title over in any way, shape or form, even though Juventus did look obviously very good against Roma on Sunday.
Well, definitely, I don't think that the title race is over. You've got Juventus now 8 points ahead of Roma and 10 points ahead of Napoli. But you've got the whole second half of the season to go. Juventus have to go to Napoli. They've got to go to Milan. They've got Inter at home. They've got to go to Roma later on in the season, so we don't know if that will count or not. But certainly up until March, Juventus have a lot of difficult games. Having said that, so have Roma and Napoli. Napoli have to go to Verona, of course, next Sunday, which will be a massive match. But there's so many matches to play. And I know that here the Italian press have almost given up on the title, but I've seen down through the years, I've seen certainly 10, 12-point advantages being reined in towards the end of the season. Anything can happen. Injury, suspensions. Of course, Juventus are no longer in the Champions League, but do have the Europa League, and the final is in Turin, so they won't be taking that lightly. And as Antonio Conte said, 8 points is nothing. And the worry is his players may be switching off and believing that the title is over. I don't believe that, and that's not Conte's way. As we saw on Sunday, he's very well prepared. But certainly I don't think that the title race is over. And then also in that match, 3-0, the final score, but I didn't see three goals between the sides. Juventus played it very much like a European tie. They sat right back the first 15 minutes. I don't think that they created one chance. When they did, they got the goal. Then they sat back again. Before that, Roma could have been 1-0 ahead. Would have been a different match if Ljajic had taken that chance. Beginning the second half, as Conte always wants his teams to come out strongly, they got the second goal, a routine goal, that has to be said. And then from 2-0, obviously became difficult, but it wasn't as if Juventus then went pushing, looking for a third goal. They sat back again and nullified Roma completely. And for the home side to play in that manner, it shows that Conte showed Roma a lot of respect, and he wanted to get this game out of the way, because remember last season when they returned after the winter break, they had a poor run. They lost to Sampdoria, and if I remember correctly, they only won once in January. So he wanted to get off on the right foot, and of course a big boost for morale. But as I said before, still a long way to go.
It's Roma's first loss of the season against Juventus, and it's no sad thing to lose against the side that's on top of the Serie A table and to have won the last two league titles, of course. Does losing actually take the pressure now off Roma? because everybody was talking about this undefeated run. Will they now kind of, they won't be guarding that, safeguarding that anymore?
Definitely, I totally agree. In a way, it can't be a good thing, of course, to lose. But when they look at their performance and when they analyse it, I'm sure Rudy Garcia will see things that he can improve. But he'll also take the positives from that, and also he'll say to the players, "Okay, we're back to the beginning again. We start again. Let's go on another run. Let's go through January and February without losing a game. Let's keep up the pressure." It seems he is that type of person. In the past, we've seen that. Certainly, I always remember Roma in January, very poor after the winter break, a team that does not like to go on to the winter break. Remember it with Capello back in 2003-04 when they were leading the title race. It looked as if they were going to run away with it. They lost at the turn of January to Milan, who eventually went on to win the title, and then had a poor run. But I can't see it happening this time. They've got a good run of games coming up. Genoa at home. And then Livorno at home. So there's two games where you're looking for 6 points. And of course, it all depends on Juventus as well, how they perform. But certainly for Roma, as you said, the pressure's off. There's no need now to consider the rest of the season going unbeaten. But they can start once again building a positive run. And they've got to also think that Napoli are improving as well. And Napoli are just tucked in behind them. And so they've got to keep Napoli at arm's length and at the same time keep in touch through to the springtime with Juventus. And as I say, the springtime is when March, April, when you really decide where the title's going to go.
It's unlikely that, as you just said a moment ago, that Milan will repeat that feat of closing down on Juventus in any way, shape or form and pushing for a title. But yesterday's result against Atalanta, a big boost to a Milan side that really needs a kick of confidence early on, sat down there after this last round of games in 11th place still in the Serie A table, starting off the year on the front foot at least. And it's similar to what we saw with Allegri last season.
Yes, Allegri came into the match and he said that this game is a relegation battle, and it shows how far Milan have fallen away. What is it, 22 points? They're one behind Lazio, one ahead of Cagliari in mid-table. Really sums it up. Whatever you say about beating Atalanta in the past, Milan wouldn't even considered a match against Atalanta more than a training match. All due respect to Atalanta. Of course, they lost Atalanta last season, and that was the beginning of, you could see that Milan were beginning to fall away. And certainly this season, it is that victory really papering over the cracks in the side. They had, of course, Brian Cristante coming in, an 18-year-old, great for the future. But you can't rely on an 18-year-old to run the midfield, in the centre of the midfield. Ricky Kaká back to... I wouldn't say to his best, because obviously he is in his twilight years, but got his 100th and 101st goal, which great for him, a great lift. So any little thing to lift the morale around the camp is going to be taken with a lot of gratification, if you like. But they've got to travel to Sassuolo on Sunday evening, and in the past you think, well, that's a banker for Milan, but if they slip up again against Sassuolo, again we're back into the negative feelings, as it is in football. You know, you can go, we've seen it, you can go a couple of games with a victory and then all it needs is a defeat and you're back into that negative territory, which Milan have been in with the things around the club, of course, with the new management, if you like, with Silvio Berlusconi's daughter, Barbara Berlusconi, taking over the reins more, and Galliani being pushed to the sidelines. There's an extra boost, of course, with the arrival of Honda, which we'll see how he fits into Italian football, but certainly that has got Milan back on the front pages in a positive manner. There's a big official unveiling is tomorrow, and that we'll see how he fits in with the side, but as I say, 22 points this season. When you look at Juventus 49, Roma 41, Napoli 39, it's a long way to go. Even to get into a European place, when we're looking at Verona playing so well, Fiorentina, of course, they can't be considered out of it yet, even though they've lost Giuseppe Rossi, unfortunately. They're on 36 points, Inter 31. So still a long way for Milan to go.
It's a long uphill struggle. What does Allegri's announcement that he won't be staying on after this season, does that affect the side, the players in any way, shape or form in the second half of this year? Because they know that they're playing for a manager who's not going to be there and dealing with any problems come the end of the season next year.
Exactly. But on the other side, they're also playing for their futures. A new coach will come in. The odds on, it will be Clarence Seedorf. And he will want to make changes and he'll have his own ideas. So those players will be playing for their future. So, of course, for them on a personal level, they'll want to do their best. And plus, they'll want to, Milan have to be in Europe. Of course, there's no divine right for any team to be in Europe. And Roma and Inter were out of Europe this season. But for Milan, who are in the only Italian club left in the Champions League, not to make Europe next season would be a big hit for them, for the club also to get new players in as well. So Allegri is professional. He'll be on his way in the summer, but he'll want to leave on a positive note, getting Milan into Europe, be it in the top three, which, as we said, very difficult, or more than likely through the Coppa Italia, which starts this week, of course. And if he gets into the Europa League via that route, so be it. And it'll be a rebuilding program for Milan.
Well, as long as he gets us into Europe, I don't think I mind too much about that. Before we let you go, Richard, just what about the ins and outs this January in Italian football? There's discussion around Inter possibly bringing in some new faces. Roma we saw dabble slightly in August. You can imagine that Juventus might bring in somebody, although there's talk as well that they will be extending Andrea Pirlo's contract today. What are they going to be the big kind of contractual stories off the pitch in January, do you think?
Well, certainly when you think of Inter, they're in need of new faces. Last night against Lazio, they were pretty terrible. It has to be said. The problem for Inter, of course, is that maybe Guarin will be leaving, maybe going to Chelsea. And last night he was out of sorts in the match. So certainly the problem really with Inter is that the change of ownership. And the new owner getting his feet under the table and getting the advice. It could be a situation where they have to hang on and wait for the summer to bring in new players. D'Ambrosio, one feels from Torino, is a left back, so not a major signing, will probably arrive from Torino. Certainly the defence needs to be shored up. There's a lot of pressure in the midfield as well. Milito, of course, out for a long time, injured. So for Inter, there doesn't seem a lot of movement on the transfer market. For Roma, Nangolan will join them today. He's just arrived, in fact, in Rome for his medical. And that's a good signing for Roma in that midfield area, which suggests that maybe Bradley could be on his way. That remains to be seen. He wasn't brought on against Juventus, which was strange enough in that midfield area, maybe just to close things up, which suggests maybe there might be something going on there about a move. And, of course, Roma brought in Paredes from Argentina today, who's he's not a European citizen, so they've got to fit him in, probably loan him out, but also Bradley, not a European citizen, so they could do a swap there. As for Napoli, They look pretty good. They may try to bring in Gonolan from Lyon, who's a midfielder, and they certainly need somebody in that midfield area, in the defensive midfield area, with Barami and Ingler. Not that's probably the weak link of Napoli going forward. They're great at defence now, is certainly tightening up. They just need to strengthen that midfield area. Juventus, as you say. Definitely Pirlo will be staying. How can you do without Andrea Pirlo? And Juve, by far the strongest team. Who do they really need to bring in? Tevez and Llorente up front. But look at coming off the bench. Vucinic can come off the bench. Quagliarella. Although, having said that, Quagliarella could go to Fiorentina. Now, Fiorentina have lost Giuseppe Rossi. Now, that could be up to, what, 3-4 months? They're talking 2 for recovery, but then rehabilitation, getting back to match fitness, you're maybe talking 3-3.5 months. And then you never know what complications. So Quagliarella linked with Fiorentina. Also, another one out of the blue, Di Natale linked with Fiorentina. Well, that could be a little bit more difficult. He had a little bit of an outburst at the weekend where he said he was retiring at the end of the year. He's feeling it now. Udinese slipping away, losing at home, of course, to Verona, where another old war horse, Luca Toni, continues to keep scoring and could be in the World Cup squad for Italy. But Di Natale could pop up at Fiorentina, although I don't think so. I think he'd probably just want to see out the rest of the season. For the rest, the usual movement around the lower reaches, Milan, of course, picking up Honda. And then there'd be a lot of players just moving around with the lower clubs, a lot of loan signings, but nothing major, really major signings in January. Always difficult to bring in big names. Milan did it last year with Balotelli, and although Honda is considered a big-ish name, it's not in the same vein as Balotelli.
Balotelli is one name that has been mentioned as a possible move away from Serie A, as is Higuain, which there was the rumours of Chelsea offering £50 million for Higuain after has been impressive in Italy this half-season for Napoli. But these are, you know, real whispers in the wind, so to speak, aren't they, Richard? There's no likelihood of these taking place.
Totally, no, not at all. Balotelli, he'll be staying at Milan. There's no doubt that he is still Milan's main focus and best player. Hasn't been on at his best. But part of the problem is what's surrounding Milan. Mm-hmm. The management, all due respect to some of his teammates, not at the level, but he maybe thought he was coming to. And he's not the type of player, he's not like Ibrahimovic, who can take a whole team on his shoulders and enjoys that. Balotelli's a different type of player. Wonderful player, of course, and he will definitely be staying at Milan. I wouldn't say riots in the street, but there'd be a major disappointment of Milan.
There were riots when he turned up. So if he leaves, then it could well be.
Know. And Higuain, there's no way. I mean, he's been such a wonderful buy for Napoli. And, you know, Napoli this season, new manager, new players coming in with a lot of changes. And they're in there. They're definitely in with a chance of, pushing for the title, if not one of the top three places, which is then for the Champions League. And, I think we've become so used now in football for instant success that, most of the time it doesn't happen. Didn't happen with Juventus when they came back up from Serie B. It took two and a half years to even get into Europe. And then from there they built. Napoli have got a program ahead, 5-year program, to be a dominant force in Italian football and also make inroads into the Champions League. Roma, the same project ahead, a 5-year project. And if the season finishes with Juventus winners, Roma or Napoli second and third, all three of clubs will be very pleased with that. What we're looking after that is the improvement of Fiorentina, the improvement Hellas Verona. They are becoming the real surprise package of the season and the real team of the season. Personally, I hope they can keep it going and really mix things up. That forces the likes of Milan and Inter to rethink their policies of what players they bring in, not just go for free transfers or big name signings, but to bring actual players through and build for the future, because one feels that the future of Italian football will rely on these types of players that come through, don't cost a lot, as Roma have shown this year and last year with Lamela and Marquinhos, and then you can sell them on and bring other players through. Long gone are the days where Italian football can just delve into their deep pockets and buy whoever they want around the world. That is gone. So it's got to be changes. So I think positive times ahead. We won't see big moves on the transfer market, but at the same time, it's a very exciting second half of the season ahead for us.
And it always provides entertaining viewing, does Serie A. Richard, we'll have to leave it there because I know you're a very busy man indeed, and I don't want to keep you for too long today, that's for sure. But we really appreciate you taking the time out to give us a fantastic overview of the January transfer market in Serie A as we head into the new year and, of course, the second half of the season with Juventus starting to pull away from the pack. But I love you keeping the faith with Roma that they're still not out of it just yet. And I need to apologise to you as well, actually, Richard, because there was a list came out of some of the best football articles and pieces of football media of 2013, and we sent out a tweet from World Football Daily, and I sent out a list of all the people who come on World Football Daily who featured on this best of 2013 list, and I left your name off it. So I humbly apologise, Richard. I've sent one out today for you, giving you the full credit that you deserve, and I hope you can forgive us here at WFD, mate.
Of course, I can give you guys anything. Hopefully, I'll make the list next year.
I'm sure you will if you keep coming on World Football Daily with information like you give us today, mate. I would guarantee it almost very much. But for now, Richard, take care. Have a wonderful early start to 2014, and we hope we can catch up with you very soon indeed, mate.
Thank you as always.
Thanks very much. Richard Whittle there joining us here on World Football Daily, taking us through Serie A as the new season continues. You can find Richard as an Italian football commentator and, of course, writer at Calcio and Coffee, covering all things Serie A. Follow him on Twitter at RichWMan. That's Rich with a capital R, R-I-C-H, W with a capital W, of course, and Man, M-A-N, at RichWMan on Twitter. Richard Whittle, what a top guy, joining us here on World Football Daily and willing to forgive us for our blunders. The Italian season kicked off once again. A good win for AC Milan last night, as we were saying earlier. Parma with a 3-1 win over Torino. Napoli taking apart Sampdoria, but not the most convincing win, I have to say. Verona with a 3-1 win over Udinese. And there, as Richard said, their incredible season continues. I wonder if Tim Parks is writing a new book about their year at the moment. And anybody who doesn't know what that is, just search Tim Parks on Amazon and you'll find his book about how this season he travelled around with Verona. As an English writer being brought in to almost the Verona Ultra, so to speak, travelling to all the away games and stuff. It's an absolutely incredible read. Genoa getting a 2-0 win against Sassuolo. Lazio beating Inter, a sloppy Inter side as well. Fiorentina with a 1-0 win over Livorno. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Chievo against Cagliari, a 0-0 draw. Juventus, that 3-0 win against Roma. But got to say it once again. Big thanks there to Richard Whittle for joining us here on World Football Daily. So almost mortifiedly embarrassed when I realised that I'd forgotten to leave him off the list. I tweeted out earlier, and we retweeted on World Football Daily earlier in the week. There's a group called A Football Report. They put out a list of their favourite articles and the best written articles from around world football. Of 2013, a whole host of our guests ended up on that list. Grant Wall, Andy Brassel, you know, Mr. Ginkers himself, Giancarlo Rinaldi, some cracking writers made that list. And Richard Whittle made the list, and I completely, I don't want to say forgot, because that makes it sound like I knew it was there, and I should have put his name on it, and I just didn't put his name on the initial tweet that had the list of all of the people that made the best of 2013 football writers list from.
Here's probably why, Juice, and let me try to, you know, dig you out of this hole.
I ran out of characters. You know, all these guys have got really long Twitter names. Oh, it just takes it all up. No, here's who it was. There was Jeff Carlisle, Grant Wall, Giancarlo Rinaldi, Jack Lang of Snap, Cacker and Pop, and Dandy Brassel all made the list, and Richard Whittle did as well, and I left him off that initial tweet. I've put one out today apologising to him, but I'm glad that we got him on today so I could apologise almost as face-to-face as you can get, really.
Sure. But in all seriousness, I was going to say that, you know, he's not necessarily a specific football writer. He does.
It covers audio, best kind of audio coverage as well, and media coverage, i.e., skits, pieces made for TV, pieces made for radio, stuff like that.
Does everything from producing highlight shows for Serie A for, you know, English language distribution around the world, He does do, you know, he does write, of course. He does commentary work, obviously. And he is, like, literally a Renaissance man of Italian football. And that's probably, you know, why, you know, the other guys fit so nicely into that kind of writer's, bucket, I guess. Whereas, you know, Richard Whittle, he's this, that, the other, and then some. So,
he's Mr. Fingers in the Pies in Italian football.
I like that. Fingers in the pie, yes. I thought you were going to say something about, like, how you jinxed him and his Roma squad heading into that.
No. I was all for Roma getting something over Juventus, but it unfortunately just didn't seem to take place. I'm sorry about that. I am delighted, of course, that Kaká bagged his 100th goal for AC Milan against Atalanta in their 3-0 win. What is it about, you know, you skip over January, you go into a new year, and suddenly Milan look like a really decent... I know it was only against Atalanta, but Milan looked like a good side yesterday. It does my head in.
How not only does Kaká score his 100th, but one of your new boys gets his first goal, right?
I couldn't give a... Ref, I'm not going to lie. I couldn't give too much of a toss about the new guys that have come into Milan at the moment, because none of them excite me. None of them have looked like game changers for us. Sure. So well, I don't...
They're no Kaká. They're no, you know, they're no Pato. They're not the same names that you know you're used to Milan bringing in. That's for sure.
Like Cristante, for instance, who, as you say, bagged his first league goal. You know, he's a youth product more than anything else. It's not like a, it's, and what's funny is that Allegri came out the other week and said, we need to not be thinking about youth so much, and we shouldn't be overpraising these youth players who haven't really done much yet. So. For Allegri to come out in that, and then people are trying to say, oh, look at the young boy getting his first goal. Look, it's a great achievement and whatnot, but it's not... I'm not that excited about it. Similarly, I'm not excited about Rami in this Milan side. You know, he's not really impressed at Valencia that much, and I'm not too fussed about it. They seem like cheap buys, and cheap purchases, and obviously bringing in youth is obviously better than buying and going out and spending loads on a player. But this is a Milan side that need to go out and spend a bit of money, because they're just falling behind at the moment in Serie A, and they don't have a quality in depth. And that's my problem with Milan. That's my beef with Milan. What did you make? I don't know if you've seen this actually, so I'll explain what's happened. Obviously Giuseppe Rossi has been injured. Another horror challenge from Ronaldo on Giuseppe Rossi during Fiorentina's clash this week. And Carlo Gaganese of Goal.com, very good friend of the show, has said that basically the Livorno player should be out of action and unable to play for the same amount of time that Giuseppe Rossi is out of action and unable to play due to this injury. It's going to be around about a 2-month injury. He's getting come across to the US to get special doctors and scans to have a look at it, as we said earlier. Carlo has said that the defender should be out for as long as the attacking player who he injured is out for. Now, how do you subscribe to that idea, Ref? Of, you know, if Roy Keane, you know, his challenge on Alfie Ingerhaaland wasn't the only thing that ended Ingerhaaland's career. He had a bad knee anyway, but it was kind of like the final blow, pretty much. Now, Roy Keane, then, I guess, arguably, it could be said that, I know Haaland came back and made a couple of substitute appearances after it, but it could be argued that Keane did the kind of final injury that ended his career, so shouldn't be allowed to play again. I mean, where do you subscribe to this idea of defenders having the same punishment that the player who's injured is out for? Because that could be an innocuous challenge, for instance. You know, when you remember when Cisse broke his leg for Chelsea? Right. You know, he got a slight touch on the back of the heel, it tripped him up, and it was horrific. You know, his leg snapped in two, horrible accident. But in that sense, you'd have to say, well, the defender caused the contact, you know, caused him to trip and his leg to go. Surely then you're looking at, you know, Cisse is out for, you know, 8-9 months. Arguably, that defender should be out for 8-9 months unable to play until Cisse's back in action. What if he never returned? You know, how do you subscribe to this idea, mate?
Well, I understand it. It does make sense. You know, you would think that it would just kind of almost instantaneously clean up the game, but at the same time, it might soften the game just too much to where, you know, essentially, well, it might open up more goals because it'll have to cause less defending, really. I mean, if you think about it, I can't tell you how many times I've personally gone in for a hard tackle and maybe not have gotten all ball, but at least stop play. And I'm not saying I've ever injured anybody. I don't think I've ever injured anybody, but it does kind of put that seed in the defender's mind that, well, you know, like I can't really go in as hard as I might have liked to. And also it kind of like there's something very natural or there's something very instinctual where it comes to professional players playing their sport. You know, there's so much talk about, you know, not thinking as a player and just reacting and just, you know, instinctually playing at your best. And when you start adding these kind of rules, much like in the NFL here in the States, you know, the not leading with the head, not, you know, hitting at the head, not hitting. There's like a specific strike zone now that you can kind of
hit.
Yeah,
and you've got to go with the shoulder and you're not allowed to leave the feet and all that kind of stuff.
So it's the same thing. All of a sudden you're having these defenders having to do a lot more thinking than they're used to. And it kind of puts them in really tough situations. And it makes their job that much more difficult than it already is. So I don't know. I'm not the biggest fan of it, only because I just don't like it. And like you said, you run the possibility of essentially kind of lifetime bans for people if you know injured players don't ever come back. And that's I shudder to think of the players that we may or may not lose just because of that.
It is an interesting debate, and it's something we're going to open up to the social media. We're putting up links.
On the positive note, here in the States at least, they're reporting that the injury isn't as bad as feared initially.
Yeah, about 2 months we're getting told at the moment, right?
Yep. So, I mean, he could be back before the end of the season. You know, kind of like you just don't want to see Giuseppe Rossi, you know, getting injured, whether or not you are an American and you think he's a Judas or whatever.
Well, the fact he's actually come back to and played wonderfully well. You know, he's come back from his horror injury after how long is it? You know, like 12 months out or whatever, almost.
Back to back knee injuries.
You know, terrible, disastrous for him. And to come back and to playing as well as he has done in this Fiorentina side, especially when Gomez was out, and for him to come in and start scoring goals and look like the Giuseppe Rossi of old, and a player that really, I think, Italian football's probably missed quite a bit in terms of the national squad and, you know, being a threatening striker. And for this to happen straight away again, almost pretty much ending his comeback before it's properly kind of finished his comeback. And it's hopefully, as I say, he's going to be out for just the 2 months, hopefully even less than that, and should it be all ready and fit for the World Cup. Unlike Raf, super Theo Walcott. Theo Walcott's done his ACL and will be out for 6 months, expected, out of Arsenal's title push and now out of the World Cup as well. First and foremost, is this a massive loss for England? Is it a massive loss for Arsenal? Who does it affect more?
You know, I'm going to go ahead and say Arsenal, and here's why. Because I was doing a little bit of research, I was listening to a couple of talk shows since yesterday, and from what I'm gathering, in the past two seasons, Theo Walcott scores on average more goals in less time than any other player on Arsenal. So essentially, he is their best goal scorer. And I mean,
yeah, but isn't that now? Slightly redundant with the form that Giroud's had this season, with the fact that Podolski's come in and obviously has done well for him, and you've got Ozil there, Ramsey's obviously playing great.
Sure, so they have a ton of talent, but they're not putting that ball in the back of the net. And this is something that they've kind of suffered for the past past decade, if I may. You know, we always talk about Arsenal kind of passing the ball around, getting to that, you know, that final third, and not having that final ball, that final dagger, and I don't see that really kind of happening. I don't see kind of, you know, what Theo brought was something different, you know, something more than just a little bit of a tiki taka style, you know, pace, energy, flying balls down the wing. That was something that brought something different to Arsenal, and it was it was basically, in my opinion, their biggest threat because it was something unexpected for Arsenal.
They've done without a lot of these players over the season in general, in similar position that Walcott plays in. You know, Cazorla's been in and out of the side this year. You've obviously had the Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain's been out at the moment, who'd be an ideal replacement once he's fit. And apparently we're hearing today that he is going to be fit to come back and kind of almost step into Theo Walcott's shoes straight away. And that's actually going to benefit his development as the 20-year-old looks to improve his game. Obviously, Ramsey's been an excellent player in that attacking midfield. Thomas Rosicki's had a kind of resurgence of form this year. And obviously, you've got Mesut Ozil in there as well. That attacking midfield spot is the one place, I think, where Arsenal can afford to lose. You know, Podolski in there as well, sitting off Giroud, can afford to lose. Maybe losing somebody like Walcott, it almost makes selection problems slightly easier for Arsene Wenger. Obviously, it's not great that Walcott's out for 6 months, and we wish him a speedy recovery, regardless of whether you're an Arsenal fan or not. It's never nice to see a footballer or somebody get injured in such a way, unless, of course, you're one of those Spurs fans who was throwing coins and whatnot down at Theo Walcott as he was stretched off the pitch. And you can have your thoughts on that, but there's no excuse for throwing coins at an injured player or any footballer in general. It's disgusting. But I do think that, yeah, Arsenal can cope, I think, slightly better than England maybe can. You look at England, they've got, and it was a really good post actually on our Facebook wall on World Football Daily yesterday evening, with somebody saying that basically England have the most average wingers anyway. So there's plenty of average replacements to come in and step in and take Theo Walcott's place. When you look at you've got Oxlade-Chamberlain, who's obviously not the finished article yet. You've got Aaron Lennon as well. It was Mark Mullov who suggested Sean Wright Phillips as well. I think that's more just a historical debate that England have had distinctly average but quick right wingers over the past few years. I wouldn't think bringing Sean Wright Phillips into the mix would be any sort of idea. Obviously, you've got Andros Townsend coming in from his kind of great spell as a Tottenham player at the moment, and what he did for England in the World Cup qualifying games towards the end of that campaign. So there are people that you don't lose a beat, I think, if you replace Lennon with Walcott. And actually, arguably, you get better delivery from Lennon than Walcott in terms of the ball in from the flanks. You just don't get that out-and-out burst of pace and that diagonal run. So rather than actually narrowing the pitch, it might actually widen it with say, Lennon or Oxlade-Chamberlain on one side. It's a blow. He's an experienced World Cup player. I mean, let's not forget, you know, he was taken to World Cup 2002. I mean, he never played, but it's still one of the worst selections that any international team's made in terms of taking a player to the World Cup on the advice of a club manager and then doing nothing with him when you thought, oh, bring on the young kid with a bit of pace. But you can have your say on that as we go on. But I do think this isn't as bad a blow as people initially think. It's a huge blow for Theo. Huge blow for Theo. But I think for Arsenal and for England, it's maybe not so bad. We were having a few discussions over social media about this. Armin Madicane said that England desperately needs some creativity and dynamism on the wings. Theo is a top player who could have delivered both. And kind of World Football Daily gave it back to him saying, well, you know, his crossing ability has always been debated. Armin replying that, you know, he does have that experience and England need some pace in what's a pretty much a stagnant attack. But it's stagnant with Walcott in anyway. So does it change that much? Either way, some nice debate coming through about it. Also, a couple of people saying that we asked who should be taken instead of Theo Walcott to the World Cup. Somebody, Mark Stanley, coming out with the great one of Scott Sinclair. I mean, obviously an absolute joke. Scott Sinclair has ruined his career with that move to Manchester City. We had Andrew D'Alessandro saying, I think Arsenal will fold like they do every year, no matter what you have on that. No matter who, sorry, you have on that team. So a couple of people expecting Arsenal to still be under pressure whether Walcott was there or not and to choke in the second half of the year. Also, quickly, whilst we're on the social media side, Raf asked people about David Moyes and should people be starting to think that United should look for a new manager? There is a couple of people that have sounded out this Moyes out malarkey, which, you know, to me is still a bit of a joke here. but a couple of people are saying it. So what would you rather have? Would you have United looking at a new manager, or do you have United actually giving Moyes the big money to go and change this season around? And I think it's pretty much unanimous across our Facebook page that Moyes should be given more of a chance. Nicholas JW said, too much deadwood left over from Ferguson's era. Learn the lessons of modern football managers' managerial shuffle and give Moyes a chance to build. That being said, axe the friggin' 4-4-2. Sounds like Mike Bassett, that. This isn't Keenan Scholes in the centre of the park, and the lesson from the two Champions League finals v Barcelona was clear. We need three in midfield. Brian Tyrrell saying, we have a manager, give David Moyes a chance. Are you panicking already? United won the Premier League title 20 times, but give time to give someone else a chance this season. Big job he has to do, rebuilding with patience and time it will take. How long did it take, Sir Alex? Arrest my case. Have faith. So generally people thinking that, you know, Moyes should be given that chance, be given a little bit of time, faith, money and effort to do it. He has been given $200 million, supposedly, according to the papers today here in England.
I've heard 100 million, but 200 million, wow.
Well, that's one of the figures that I've heard over Twitter and through the papers today. But apparently Moyes isn't going to use most of it until the summer. He's going to wait from buying big in January, which seems almost kind of smart.
It's what I was saying yesterday, man. I think that you're not going to save your season, really. You're not going to do anything this year that is going to drastically turn around your season. In my opinion, you'll get better deals. You'll probably save some money, and you'll probably be able to do a little bit more sound business in the summer, I think, just because, you know, you're just not under pressure. You know, the January transfer window prices, you know, just blow out of proportion, and United don't need to be kind of worried about this year. And you know, I do seriously think that there's not one thing David Moyes can do to really kind of ruin his chances and get fired this year. I just don't picture that happening.
What about bringing in Juan Mata? Would that not?
Well, from what I hear, I hear he's going back to Spain. But
yeah, it's the rumor mill is that he will be leaving Chelsea though this January because he wants to play to get himself sorted out for the World Cup this coming summer, which is fair enough. But
it would be very cheeky of Mourinho to kind of let him go to a rival like that, because I mean, surely whether or not Mourinho likes him and whether or not he fits into Mourinho's kind of tactics, I seriously think that Mourinho at least respects the talent and understands that he's, you know, a quality player, and he's not going to, you know, send him off to somebody who could turn around and use him to sting him, basically.
And do you not think as well that maybe Mata might kind of be hesitant about a move to Manchester when you see how, for instance, Kagawa, who is a player who was tipped to succeed and obviously was wonderful in the Bundesliga, has kind of been treated? You know, he's not been played in that right position, he's not getting regular game time, and there's still a lot of battles in that attacking midfield, much like at Chelsea, for positional places. I mean, you look at somebody like Zaha, who's come in and was hoping to be able to play and make an impact early on, and never has been kind of given that opportunity this year. I mean, a couple of people suggested that's who United should buy, Juan Mata, and I thought it still doesn't solve any of the problems for them at all. It still needs to be, as we kind of tried to avoid talking about with Jeremy Wilson yesterday, it still needs to be a replacement for, as it was said in that Facebook message, the Scholes and Keane and the heart of that midfield and that defence as well. It's far too leaky, far too leaky. There are plenty of players, though, that will be looking to move about this January, I'm sure, especially as they look for game time to rejuvenate their World Cup prospects for this summer. And one person who I'm still amazed hasn't been picked up after he was absolutely incredible last season down at Queen's Park Rangers, was excellent in the Confederations Cup, is goalkeeper, former Inter keeper, Julio Cesar. Now, Inter got rid of him and brought in Handanovic, and he's done wonderfully well and was an excellent, excellent buy, as I'm sure Richard, if we'd asked him about it earlier, would have said. And I think we did have somebody last season kind of say that purchase of Handanovic was probably the best purchase in Serie A, considering the talent they lost with Julio Cesar. But Cesar's now stuck playing championship football. This is a Brazil international keeper that everybody under the sun was thinking we're going to pick off from QPR for cheap come their relegation. And he's still stuck down playing championship, second-tier football. Now, yeah, it's beyond belief to me. It seems ridiculous that a player of this calibre is still stuck down in the lower levels of English football. And considering the number of teams that supposedly have had goalkeeping problems, most of them seem to be resolved, to be honest. The resurgence of Wojciech Szczęsny this season. Obviously, Peter Cech's still there, and they've got Courtois over at Atletico Madrid on loan, ready and waiting probably to come back, much like a Romelu Lukaku is. Obviously, David De Gea has improved dramatically this season, and there's nobody kind of baying for blood around him. Liverpool have brought in Mignolet after losing Pepe Reina. I mean, those top sides, obviously Everton have got Tim Howard as well. Those top sides are pretty set in terms of goalkeeping. The only one would have been Joe Hart, but he's suddenly come back with some form after a disastrous mid part of the first half of the season. And suddenly, Julio Cesar is now a keeper left without a club. Now, I'll tell you what, I would love him at Milan. Absolutely love him at Milan. And obviously, I think goalkeeper is one of those few places where, aside from the off-the-pitch stuff, you can go anywhere in football as a goalkeeper and fit straight in. Because all you're doing is you're making saves. You know, the difference
is... Do you think that playing in kind of lower leagues as a keeper, you know, dulls down your skills at all? Or does it help you because you're, you know, I don't know, playing with the worst defense? Or
well, I think, for instance, you've seen Brad Guzan get better and better because he gets tested and tested so often by that leaky Aston Villa defense. And in the same way, you know, Cesar last year made an impressive name for himself because, you know, QPR were allowing so many shots to come through at him. And he was pulling off a number of fantastic saves. But I don't think it helps his stock in any way, shape or form on the international stage when he's not going to be able to be playing in European tournaments as a keeper of his level arguably deserves to be, really.
Right. Yeah, no, I just kind of, yeah, I worry. I mean, he was just such a fantastic keeper at Inter. And I mean, the move to QPR kind of really scared me just because I never really believed in QPR, man. It just... I don't know. Do you think Chris Samba, the mercenary that is Mr. Samba, is he coming back to the Premier League again? After his eighth transfer of the season or something like that?
Well, you never know with Christopher Samba, do you? I mean, he is, as you say, just the...
Put that one out there just because I remember hearing about him yesterday. And I just, again, the January transfer window to me, Juice, is just absolutely ridiculously fun and entertaining. So, yeah, I'm sorry. I am getting a bit distracted.
Well, he only just joined... where is he now? Moscow, isn't he? Christopher Samba, Dynamo Moscow. He only just joined them this season, but you wouldn't put it past him making another move somewhere else, considering he's been at three different clubs, four different clubs, if really, in the last kind of year and a half. So you wouldn't put it past, you know, Christopher Samba coming to a football club near you. I do like the fact that West Ham have brought in Roger Johnson on loan for the remainder of the season, the man who's been relegated in three consecutive years. It always baffles me when managers kind of that take a team down to the Championship then get a Premier League job the following year. Sheffield Wednesday hired Danny Wilson and Paul Jewell off relegation seasons. It always baffles me how they get those sorts of jobs. And in the same way, Roger Johnson, a man who was playing alongside Scott Dan at Birmingham City, Scott Dan made him look excellent. Dan left. Birmingham looked terrible without him. Johnson then left after being relegated with Birmingham, went off to Wolves, disrupted the whole team, disrupted the kind of the club internally off the pitch by being given the captaincy, took him down, and then took him down again. And then West Ham think that this is the solid defender to save their season at the moment. It's a bit of a cheap panic buy, I think, by Sam Allardyce. Well, loan in anyway, especially as Sheffield Wednesday were eyeing him up. But I'm quite glad, to be honest, that we're not going to be bringing him in this January for another second half of the season, that's for sure. We asked yesterday very quickly as well, if you had £15 million for your club, who would you bring in? Abdullah says Juan Mata to Inter. He says Palacio needs supply and there's not enough creativity at the club. That's not too bad. Raul says Freddy Guarin from Inter should come to Chelsea. I'm presuming it's Chelsea anyway because his Twitter picture is a shot of Jose Mourinho. Bibash Das says Mohamed Salah to Manchester United. Joaquim, Mr. Morning Pint himself, has said that's hardly enough to buy anyone anymore. That's what you got to think about it, Joaquim. You got to think, what would you do with 15 million? Rather than just splurging Chelsea money, what would you do? And Jonathan Lee says Kabay to Liverpool would be a great buy. Now, that is a good shout with Gerrard kind of on the wane Kabay, who obviously was unsettled so much at the start of the season with those Arsenal rumours and couldn't play because of how he was, his head wasn't right. Liverpool, would that be a pretty tasty pickup for Brendan Rodgers if he could do that? But he also thinks that Newcastle should snap up Remy with that money ASAP. And Ricky Lambert to go to West Ham as well, he's saying. He's given us three expected transfer buys and from January. Fair play, Jonathan. I don't see Lambert going to leaving Saints, to be honest. He's like what's the lad who played up front? Grant Holt. There we go. He's like a Grant Holt to me. Grant Holt at Norwich, excellent striker. If he goes anywhere else, not scoring goals. In the same way, Lambert at Southampton, he feels comfortable, he feels settled, he'll score goals. Goes anywhere else, ends up becoming a massive flop. So I don't see that one happening. But the Kabay to Liverpool one, I very much like. Very much like, Raf.
Yeah. Grant Holt, did he ended up getting like a run out for England at one point, didn't he?
Yeah, he got a run out, and people were saying that he should have gone to the World Cup because he was the highest scoring Englishman in the Premier League. Not the World Cup, the Euros, sorry, because he was the highest scoring Englishman in the Premier League the season before the tournament. Nah, I'm sorry. No, I moan about England and probably sound quite hypocritical on a lot of occasions about it all, but I do want to see players of a slightly better quality than Grant Holt playing for England, even if I don't want them to win a World Cup while they're playing absolutely appalling football. Raf, there's one thing I definitely want to ask you about as well. Stateside, there's been a real confusion going on. Let's put it that way. Very odd story coming out involving Vancouver. Have you seen this at all?
I did, yeah. With the player kind of issues going on, right?
Yeah, with and unfortunately the name has completely gone off the top of my head, and I was basically reading up on this story all day long. Camilo going down to Mexico, signing for a Liga MX team, apparently. Although nobody said he signed, but he was paraded out in a shirt as the club's new striker. Right, yet he's still on contract with...
denying the deal in general.
Yeah, he's still on contract with Vancouver.
And Vancouver said he's going nowhere.
Yeah, Vancouver said no, he's our player. I mean, I don't. How are people reacting in the US to this? Because apparently it's not the first time this has happened either. Camilo Sanvezo, the Golden Boot winner of Major League Soccer last season, where it's caught Quintero, that's who it was, been caught kind of wearing their shirt out on their Twitter feed as their supposed new signing. Yet Vancouver is saying that they're going to run the option on his contract, the 1 year option they have for the 2014 season. Now, this is like Peter Odemwenge times 10, isn't it? Yeah. You know, Odemwenge just turned up in a car. How does Camilo go back to Vancouver after this? You know, wearing the club shirt, being on their news feed.
Uh-huh.
This is...
On Twitter, yeah, no. It is absolutely strange. And, I mean, the fact that... Here's what I'm reading a lot of, and here's the response that I'm kind of gauging, I guess, here, is that a lot of MLS fans and a lot of, you know, American soccer fans almost feel like it's, you know, well done to Vancouver for keeping on to your player, you know, like it's almost like a win for the Americans because and Canadians, I guess, obviously Vancouver. But anyways, you get what I'm saying. The MLS win for the MLS because you know, they're sticking it to the Mexicans. They're sticking it to Liga MX, and you know, it's like a win for them because they are holding on to their talent. Is the way that they are seeing this. I'm like you, man. This could potentially. Well, I feel like I'm like with you. I feel like this could be just a very bad rotten apple that could kind of turn the tide in the dressing room for Vancouver in the wrong way. And that's something that you don't necessarily want or need, you know, as a newer team in Major League Soccer.
Well, not just a newer team, but a team that in that Pacific Northwest is, I don't want to say getting bypassed, because obviously Vancouver have looked strong. Well, looked stronger last season, but compared to how Seattle and Portland are running the show at the moment, there's two of the top three MLS franchises in terms of financial clout. That they are kind of slipping behind in that Cascadia Cup kind of ranks and whatnot. So this just doesn't help their stature as a club up there in the Pacific Northwest. It doesn't really help Major League Soccer either. You know, somebody who's not doesn't know the league that well or anything like that is going to look at this and kind of be laughing at it, you know. But you have to, this was something interesting actually that was pointed out yesterday, that Querétaro have, this isn't the first weird thing that they've done. Apparently the club touted that they signed DeMarcus Beasley at one point this winter, only to have not secured any sort of signature at all from him. So, I mean, this Querétaro seem to be almost like the jester club of Mexico. Like, hey, we got your players. Ah, no, we don't. We haven't got them at all. We've got nothing. We've got nothing. But very interesting to see how this story is going to run. Very interesting to see how Vancouver deal with this. And to see what the player says as well. You know, having the MLS Golden Boot winner want to go down to Mexico is not, you know, beyond the pale, so to speak. You know, you wouldn't, it's not surprising that he probably wants to maybe move down to Mexico, maybe possibly make a little bit more money, win a CONCACAF Champions League, something like that. But for this kind of whole palaver to be around, it makes it very interesting indeed. It'll be really, really interesting to see how this plays out over the next few days, because I imagine Vancouver are going to want to react quickly to sort out this whole situation. I mean, I still think there's a possibility that he could then be sold down to Liga MX Camilo with this going on, because you can't, surely he can't return to the club.
Right. Well, and you know, if they can nip this in the bud sooner than later, they can potentially, you know, find a replacement and bring somebody else in, things like that. Yeah, I mean, it's
difficult to replace a 22-goal man from the last season, though.
Absolutely. I mean, yes. You know, especially when you are kind of, you know, lowest on the totem pole in terms of, one, the Pacific Northwest rivalries, and two, the general Canadian rivalries. I mean, you could argue that they're above Toronto.
They're above Toronto. Yeah. Come on, Raph. Yeah. They are above Toronto. Sure. It's the impact.
Before we leave, I kind of wanted I read this article that was kind of interesting. You know, obviously, with the passing of Eusebio, we're going to have a very special kind of tribute to him on our Wednesday show. But I just wanted to kind of throw this out there to you real quick. Obviously, Eusebio, just an incredible figure on the world stage. Most soccer fans, whether they are, you know, slightly into the game or full-fledged, you know, supporters of any club, they generally have heard of that name. It's just that well-known. It carries a lot of weight. It carries a lot of, you know, credibility. But I was reading an article that basically was kind of, you know, saying, obviously, you know, well, this guy's girlfriend basically came up and said, who's this Eusebio guy who's trending all over, you know, the internet and stuff? And it just shocked him. He literally fell back into his chair and was just dumbfounded. I understand how a girlfriend cannot know about these things, but he went on to write this article about just a couple other, you know, household names that should be just known around the world, no matter who you are, no matter what sports you like or whatever. Some names like Juice Fontaine, Puskas, things like that, Zico, Garincha, stuff like that. Mm. Now, there's one that I just kind of want to throw out there to you and see if you knew. Well, there's actually two. Here's the kind of off-the-wall one, and I'll give you a hint. He's a Welshman. His name, John Charles. Do you got anything for me? Do you know anything about the Welsh player, probably the best Welsh player in the history, in John Charles?
What, you mean better than Gareth Bale? I don't remember him at all going anywhere. No, he played at Juventus, didn't he, at one point?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he's a Leeds United player and Juventus. And again, just generally highly regarded as one of the best Welsh players ever to play the game. The last one,
interesting if Juve J's got any thoughts on John Charles, actually. Cause
Yeah.
It was a big part of his career, wasn't it?
That was the biggest move of his career. And he played an incredible, you know, spell with Juventus as well. Now, obviously, most Englishmen know the great Sir Bobby Charles. But
Charlton. Or Charles.
Yeah, sorry. Sir Bobby Charles. Yes. I have
no idea who Sir Bobby Charles is. Yeah.
Right. So, but there's another knighted English player that I wanted to kind of ask you about.
Not David Beckham. He missed out on the knighthood honors this year, by the way. Just throwing that out.
How about a Mr. Stanley Matthews?
Stanley Matthews. Come on, mate. Yes. Everybody knows who Stanley Matthews was. Played at Stoke. I had a chat with this guy called Brian Glanville, who is one of the best football writers you'll ever meet. Okay, he's really, really old doddery guy. Okay, and I met him down at the Emirates last season or season before that. So well spoken, so well written, and he and I spent pretty much the whole of this Arsenal game. I think it was Arsenal Swansea chatting. And I was watching the game and kind of chatting out the side of my mouth. And he was pretty much sat like facing me chatting for the whole of this game. And I thought to myself, like, you know, how can this guy, he's barely watched a match, it seems. Like, how can he do a match report and whatever? And as soon as full time happened, the final whistle goes, he gets up, stands up, walks just to the back of the press area, still out in the stands, pulls out a really old mobile phone. No smartphone rubbish around here. We're talking, you know, like Nokia 3210 type thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And starts calling up the Times, I think it was, to kind of reel off a match report that a woman down the phone would be quoting. And not only did it have every single incident, time, moment, important moment in that game in it, it was also so well spoken and therefore well written. You know, it wasn't just a chronological order of events. It was the discussion of, you know, the build up of each individual moment, and not just kind of in order. It was kind of done in waves of Arsenal's attack game here and then this, but Swansea, as they'd shown in the first half with X, Y, Z, and then took that flow into the second half and almost carried it. It was absolutely fantastic. And I just sat there kind of a bit dumbfounded as I kind of tapped away. I wish I could do what he does right now. But he once wrote a very interesting piece for World Soccer magazine about how Jermaine Pennant could have been the next Stanley Matthews had he not kind of basically lacked the effort and the drive kind of off the pitch. It was a very interesting read indeed. But no, Stanley Matthews, one of the all-time greats.
One of the things that kind of stood out for me about Stanley Matthews was he played until he was essentially 50 years old, the oldest footballer really playing professionally.
And he was probably still smoking like 20 pack a day or something like that at the same time as well from back in those days. No, everybody knows who Stanley Matthews is. And it's weird as well because he didn't play for any like massive clubs or anything like that. You know, he never...
Stoke and Blackpool.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about Blackpool. I knew it was the majority of his time was at Stoke, but I forgot about Blackpool. But yeah, you know, no kind of Liverpool, Arsenal, anything like that. No, very interesting indeed.
It's so good he was knighted while he was still playing.
We will have a big chat with Tom Kunder at Portugal.net coming your way tomorrow about Eusebio, the legacy that he leaves on Portuguese football, which is a massive one. Of course, the 9 goals in World Cup 1966, the Golden Boot winner of that, but more importantly, what he did for Portuguese football, and hosts of floods of kind of sympathy and regret coming across Twitter, social media, from all of Portuguese football's greats, including Cristiano Ronaldo, saying how sorry they are to see Eusebio passing away earlier on this week. We will have that coming your way tomorrow, and all the upcoming football chat from around the January transfer window. We'll also try and take a quick look at Spain as well before we start previewing some of the weekend's football coming up on Thursday and Friday. There's, of course, the Capital One Cup semi-finals taking place tonight as well. Rafa, is it going to be a shock result in either of these two games, to be honest? Because I can't see either of the United sides getting toppled. I know United are in a shoddy way at the moment, and I just don't see Sunderland capitalizing on it yet.
No chance. I don't think so. United should have more than enough to get past Sunderland.
No chance for Sunderland, says Rafa. I kind of concur with him as well. We'll leave it there for today. A big thanks to Richard Whittle for joining us and talking us through all things Serie A, especially over the Christmas break and leading through into the January transfer window. Milan might be a little busier, might be pretty shoddy this second half of the season still. I'm giving up on them this year. Let's rebuild for next season. Rebuild for the 2014-15 season. That's the one that really matters. A big thanks to all of you who joined us today. A big thanks to everybody who's got interactive with us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and, of course, show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter, 310-909-8483. Is the rant line, the Facebook page as well. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Take care. Enjoy the football this evening. And let's hope that Sunderland can pull off an upset at home against the Red Devils in the Capital One Cup semi-final first leg. Take care.